Welcome to the Transatlanticist podcast at the America Centrum in Hamburg. As always, I am your host of the Politics Podcast, Andrew Sola. And today I'm absolutely delighted that we're taking the Transatlanticist on the road for the first time since the coronavirus pandemic. I am in the beautiful city of Oslo, in the beautiful country of Norway, with my handsome guest, Dr. Trygve Svensson. Welcome, Trygve. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Andy. I'm delighted to be here as well. And thank you for all the compliments, which, by the way, I totally agree with.
Yes. So today we're here with Dr. Svensson because he is our expert in Norwegian politics. Dr. Svensson was the Deputy Minister for Trade and Commerce in 2013 in Norway. He then did his doctoral degree in rhetoric from the University of Bergen in 2018. After that, he worked in the office of the CEO for Equinor, which is the new name for Statoil, the old state-run oil company. And he is currently the director of the center-left think tank in Norway. And the title of that think tank is Agenda. Is that correct?
That's also right, Andy.
Okay. I can read your handwriting.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm impressed.
The first good news is I can read his handwriting. So we have a number of really important subjects to discuss today. We want to discuss internal politics issues in light of the elections coming up. And so we will talk about some issues that I think might have been important for the elections coming up, namely the COVID response by the current government. Also, maybe a little bit of a discussion about Norway and immigration and refugees. We'll talk about Norwegian oil and the climate crisis. And lots of these issues actually connect to external foreign relations issues. So we might talk a little bit about the Norwegians' attitude towards the Trump presidency and now the Biden presidency. Also, maybe Norway and NATO and the Afghanistan withdrawal. And indeed, we might get into other issues like some new initiatives you're working on here at your think tank about the freedom of expression in light of the Breivik killings and other issues. And also issues about inequality and equality. So that's a huge number of issues. Basically, keep listening, and after an hour, we will have solved all of Norway's problems and made a good start.
And we can all go home.
And we can all go home. Yes. Okay, so why don't we just start with a preview of the elections coming up in Norway?
I'd love to. In front of every election, you'll always say, oh, this is the most important election in forever, ever, right? We always say that. And of course, I'm going to say it this time as well. And I have to admit that I really feel it because we're going into the 20s, you know, and it's a political decade where, in my perspective, in Norway, we have to solve two really huge political challenges. One is the climate challenge. And the second one is the inequality challenge or crisis that I call it. If we don't turn and get things moving in the right direction within 10 years, especially when it comes to climate, which is, of course, a global issue, then, well, that's an existential threat to humankind. I'm sort of thinking that we're seeing a revival of politics. And also in my movement, the social democratic movement, which has always been a movement with a huge belief that politics it should change society, should govern society, should be in the head of society. But for the last 20 years, I mean, after Tony Blair, Third Way, where many social democrats thought, well, we also need to make some space for the market to work. We can't be the type of old school governing from the 70s. I think now in the face of climate crisis, you see social democrats center-left politicians who are thinking, well, politics needs to take a much larger role, both when it comes to climate change and also when it comes to regulating technology, for instance.
Right. So, and just to go back a little bit for our listeners who might not be aware of the third way concept in center-left politics, we can also trace this back not only to Tony Blair in Britain, but also the Clinton. The Clinton, I'm thinking of the U.S. audience, yeah. Clinton was very pro-business, mm. and so the center-left parties, as we would characterize the Democrats, as well as the SPD in Germany, mm. and your own center-left party, became more pro-business.
Yeah,
and in around the 90s, and you're suggesting the same conceptual shift or ideological shift occurred here in Norway with your party too.
It was a huge shift. It came around 2000. And suddenly you had, for instance, Equinor, where I worked, it was called Statoil. It was the state-run oil company. It was basically the architect of our huge oil fund, you might say, in combination with the tax policies, where they pay 78% tax of all they make. And it was really seen as a tool to make sure that all the oil that we found in our North Sea should benefit all of society. And suddenly, around 2000, you could see how some of these state-run companies were working around the world. And I visited some of them, the Mexican, for instance, mm-hmm. Which is not very efficiently run. And we thought, okay, we'll put it on the market. We'll make it a regular company, and we'll privatize it. The state will still own 67%, but it will be run pretty differently.
Are you talking about Equinor now or
no,
the Mexican?
I'm talking about Equinor.
Okay, Equinor.
So that was a huge policy shift that happened around 20 years ago. The same happened with Telenor, which is a telecom company. And it's a pretty interesting story. I mean, this was a directorate. It was a place you had to apply to have a telephone in your house. And it usually took about 3 months before you applied, and then you could get a telephone. And now they're a global company with 300 million customers. Mm-hmm. And it will grow up. And this happened in many companies around 20 years ago. So that's what I'm talking about when I'm with this third way of thinking. But now many of the people who were central then, they now say that, okay, that was not... I mean, this is why I'm a social democrat. Because it was a good idea at that time. At this time, I think we need more politics, mm-hmm. to put it bluntly. Mm-hmm. Less market, more politics, more direction. It's not going back to the 70s, mm-hmm. but it's doing things that could actually save the planet.
And you believe, just to go through some statistics I brought up here, you believe that your party will be the winner of the next election. I just have the most recent statistics from, in English, I should say. Mm. And your Labour Party is projected to win 24% of the votes. This was from the start of July, so they're about a month old. And the current ruling party in a coalition, a conservative coalition, the Conservative Party, is at 21%. So can we trust these polls? And I'm going to ask you about issues that are important next, but can we trust these polls? I mean, are you confident?
Well... I'm never going to say I'm confident because I'm not a politician. I'm sort of with one foot in politics and one foot in what you might call the academic world or research world. But you wouldn't find a single member of the center-left politics in Norway now who will take the victory for granted, because they did that 4 years ago and lost. Mm. So they will say, and I support that this is hard work all the way. But yesterday there was a poll where the Labour Party was at 27%.
Okay.
The Centre Party, which is a coalition partner, was at 15%. The Socialist Leftist Party was at 8%. So that's a solid lead. We also have our own Nate Silver in Norway these days.
Okay.
It's a guy called Jørgen Bøstad. He uses Bayesian statistics, the same method as Nate Silver. And I checked his website yesterday, and the chances of the Conservatives being reelected yesterday was 1.4%.
Okay.
So, I mean, I remember everybody was so angry at Nate Silver when Trump got elected, but that was like, he was at 30% chances, right? So that's like, you go into a plane and three of 10 planes will fall to the ground.
Right.
You know, you won't do that. But this is more like, okay, it's 1.4%.
Right. This is funny. And Silver's projections were actually good for the first Trump victory against Hillary Clinton, because many people, it was like this 1.5% chance that Trump will win. But Silver was way up at 30. I don't remember the point, but so these polls, we'll just say you're cautiously optimistic.
Cautiously optimistic.
But people have to get out and vote.
Yeah.
Out of curiosity, what is the level of voter turnout in Norway?
Well, it's been sadly it's been decreasing for years, but it's like in the municipalities elections is always a bit lower, around 62-63%. I think, it's really difficult to know with COVID and everything, but I'm hoping 67-68% maybe. I don't have that.
Yeah, sorry for asking.
No,
that.
That's
I should have checked that myself. That's bad research
on
my part.
No,
you can blame me.
No. But I mean, the turnout in the last US election, that was pretty awesome.
Yeah, and I think that's interesting. One argument that I make and others make as well is that the divisive politics of Donald Trump actually energized a new generation of voters. And I always look for silver linings in everything.
Yeah.
And certainly getting more people involved in politics ought to only be a good thing for democracies. So
I think since this is an academic audience, I think it sort of gives Chantal Mouffe a little point against Habermas, you know? She says polarization is good for politics.
Now you're beyond my academic understanding, but do explain.
Okay, so of course I'm a part Habermasian because I love his point about rationality, that that's something that happens not in the middle of somebody's brain, but it happens when people have a good conversation. And this is where we should look for rational decision-making. And I think that's a fantastic way of somebody who came out of the Second World War to sort of save rationalism as a concept of human, as a human value. You know, maybe he sort of saved the Enlightenment project with that idea. And then, of course, Chantal Mouffe, who has a different political, she's not a social democrat, for instance. He's a social democrat. She's more of a socialist and also, funnily, inspired by Carl Schmitt. So she says that, well, this whole idea of Habermas, that you should just have this great dialogue and it will follow these rules and then everybody will be happy and things will be rational, which is tabloid, you know? It's not really true because politics is about enemies. It's about enemies trying to win. And that's democracy. Her term is agonistic pluralism.
Antagonistic.
Sorry.
Yeah.
So she, and that's what energizes the public, and that's what make people turn out to vote. So, I think it's an interesting reflection to bring along when we want to understand Trump and the last election.
Well, let's not go there quite yet. Let's go to the list of issues that you think are most affecting the Norwegian electorate now, which social, political issues or whatever. And I, of course, as we were talking the other day, I had a list of things that I assumed that the Norwegians should be thinking about and would be influencing the elections. And they were all wrong. Like the coronavirus pandemic response by the current government. And you're like, no, that's really not decisive in this election.
No.
So, since I'm totally wrong about all of these things, tell me, what are the major issues? Because my research has not been good enough.
Hey, if you like, I'm having an op-ed this week, actually, in the largest newspaper in Norway. And it's about this, because, and the title of the op-ed is, why hasn't Erna Solberg, our prime minister, why hasn't she strengthened out of the pandemic? So I guess there's many reasons for that, because if you look at, for instance, Denmark, pretty similar country to us, Mette Frederiksen, she is the prime minister there. She got 26% in the election, and now she's polling at 33 and doing really well because she's been such a strong leader during the pandemic. And if you look at Boris Johnson, which is, I guess, the most opposite politician to Mette Frederiksen as you can find, he's also doing well,
mm-hmm.
even though the COVID response in Britain has been terrible in many ways, right? So, but somehow many leaders around Europe has come strengthened out of the COVID response. It doesn't appear to be the case in Norway. You could use like a sociological broad explanation that this is a society with a huge level of trust between people. I mean, this is where we pull top in the world.
And also trust in your government institutions.
Yeah, yeah. We trust each other, our institutions. If you lose your wallet on the street, there's a huge chance you'll get it back. I have a book in the shelf here in my office written by a friend of mine called Homo Solidaricus, mm-hmm. which is actually will be published in Germany also. And it's about, it's sort of Rutger Bergman a couple of years before he came with his book, you know, Humankind.
Mm-hmm.
It's that people are decent, they're nice, and they trust each other if you give them the chance.
Or if you have trillions of dollars of oil money and gas money to spend.
Ah, well, no, that's a typical mistake. You know,
I'm an American.
That's the mistake. The thing is, we
outline the argument for me then.
So the reason we have all this money in the bank and we are rich is because of trust. Trust comes first, then the money comes, because if you trust each other, and this is something we actually worked on when I was state secretary, that our biggest value, the reason our businesses are able to compete worldwide, I mean, this sounds disgustingly bragging, I know, but okay, I'll just go ahead and say it anyhow. So why is it possible that on the west coast of Norway, you have small companies far from the market with the highest wages in the world who are able to compete globally? They sell all their shit globally, you know, they don't sell to a home market. It's because they work more efficient than anybody else in the whole world. Why do they work so efficient? It's not because they have a special form of intelligence. It's because everybody trusts each other. So mm-hmm. if you screw up, you tell your boss immediately. If your boss screws up, you tell him you mm-hmm. screwed up.
Mm-hmm.
That's because they know that you won't lose your job. And if you lose your job, you have a social security net. So trust is like the highest currency and our biggest value. And that's why I'm so intensely occupied by inequality,
mm-hmm.
because in some regards, we're moving in the wrong direction now. But still, we trust each other. So the COVID response, I mean, people did what the government told them to do. In this city, Oslo, they took such a huge toll. People basically lived like, you know, hermits, I guess, mm-hmm. or something for such a long time. So that's one of the reasons that I think many people think it wasn't the solid leadership of the government. It was basically a quality of Norwegian society that made this possible. And then also, and this is sort of funny, I guess, is when you're talking about the political opponent, but the prime minister screwed up on a couple of occasions then this spring also. For instance, after 1.5 years of COVID, she had her 60th birthday and she held a sushi dinner at a ski resort place called Geilo. Everybody in Norway knows this place. And
this is like Gavin Newsom, the governor of California,
when everyone is
supposed to be in lockdown. And
she had 14 people for dinner.
He went to this Michelin star restaurant in San Francisco or something while everyone else was supposed to be at home.
So she had four, she had 14 people for dinner. And that was just, I mean, If there was one thing everybody knew at that point, is you don't have 14 people for mm-hmm. dinner. I think the limit in some municipalities were 10.
Mm-hmm.
Here it was like, in Oslo it was like 5, whatever. I remember especially there was this one political commentator in a fairly conservative news outlet, you know, the TV2. It's the second largest of the news outlets. And he just had a meltdown live on television because he was standing in his garden and and he was like, my wife, she just came from the 50th year birthday of her best friend. They were standing outside in the garden with huge freezing jackets, freezing 2 meters apart. And my daughter, who's 14, she can't have her friends for birth. And he was raging.
Mm-hmm.
And then the prime minister, who'd been giving press conferences daily for a year, has 14 people for sushi. So this was
inside, sushi not even gate. Freezing. Yeah.
And something changed at that moment. Yeah. I actually think so. This is
a breach
politics
of trust.
Yeah.
You're saying it was a breach of trust. And if she's fallen 3, 5, 7% in the polls, you're saying that it's because she broke the sacred thing in Norwegian society, the trust that we're all going to follow the same rules. She broke that, and it's on her then.
So
are people in her own party criticizing her for this,
they don't talk a lot about it. But I think it was a sort of a hard blow because she's been a very fascinating political figure the last 8 years and hugely popular in many ways, because she has this ability to sort of be apolitical in a way, and she does also does a lot of, you know, funny stuff. Like she has no problem with wearing funny hats, or, you know, she has this Boris Johnson thing going on where she doesn't take herself that seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's for the Conservative Party, that's a huge benefit because usually Conservatives are
stuffy.
Yeah. So that's something that people like about her. And they were planning to have her center of their campaign. So, of course, it was really shitty timing with Sushigate, you know. So I think something changed, actually, at that moment, which is everybody can make a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
But in politics, these things are pretty ruthless, you know. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Interesting. So let's go back. What are the top three issues, generally speaking, Norwegians are worried about in any election, well, in this election? What are the decisive issues? So trust, you said, and
this is something I'm super happy about, actually, because the biggest issue, well, there was a big article, front page article, a couple of weeks ago in Aftenposten, which is like the main newspaper for Oslo, and it was that social inequality is now the thing that people in Norway are most concerned about. And that's
social inequality as opposed to economic inequality, are they linked?
The Norwegian term was sosiale forskjeller. It would mean something like social differences. It's about inequality in the economic sense of the word. But this is really broad, right? It's about housing, it's about health, it's about education. It's all of these things. And in one way, I was happy about it because in Agenda, we've been working with inequality since we started up. We brought Thomas Piketty to Norway when he was really early, you know, just when we translated his book, Capital of 21st Century. So we did that early and it's been sort of like our signature issue that we've been working on all the way. And I think in a small country like ours, if you have an organization about 10, 12 people and you work on something every week, you have somebody from us writing an op-ed or participating in a debate, it has an impact, you know? I mean, this is a small country, 5 million people, a small public sphere. So I think maybe we have we sort of contributed to this. And then, of course, it's because inequality has been actually, there's more inequality now than it used to be. And then, of course, people get more concerned. So so you have the public perception of stuff, which is not always follows the rules of logic, as everybody would know. But it's also because people can actually observe it. You know, if you want to have an apartment in Oslo now, and you work as a nurse, you can afford the 2.4% of the apartments in Oslo. Mm-hmm. We're not used to that
right
here. You know, we're not used to that type of level of inequality.
So this is, you're saying the working people of Norway are the ones feeling that somehow they've been screwed over the last 20 years with the movement to a third way politics, and suddenly they're wanting to fight back a little bit.
I don't think they attach it to third way politics. I think they just, but they attach it to the way society is moving in a way, because there's been so many things happening since third way politics of 2000. But I think it's about, you have to give people a good deal, you know? There's an example, it's a sort of fun example I use from my hometown of Bergen on the West Coast, which is one of the voting circles in Bergen. Voting circles, would that be constituencies? Like, I don't know the English term for it, but when you have the municipality election, you have a...
District. Voting districts.
Yeah, voting districts. So one of the voting districts, right next to where I grew up, suddenly it emerged a political party called Bompengepartiet. It's the party which only issue was how much do you have to pay when you drive your car through the toll station, so you call it the toll station party or something,
right? A real single issue party.
And they were like, they were a bit Trumpist in their way of speaking, if you see what I mean. I mean, they resented all politics that has to do with environment in the city. They resented everything that had to do with trying to get, you know, less cars into a city that was built in the medieval age, that wasn't really built for, you know, 250,000 people driving cars in and out. And they didn't want the new tram that we were building. They were really like and hugely populist. But they got, in this district, they got from 0 to 43% of the votes. So what happened in those 4 years? This district was suddenly, and this is normal working people's district, where people need their car to get places. And they were suddenly surrounded by toll stations, and they didn't get, you know, free buses, or, you know, they didn't get anything back. So society just gave them a really shitty deal over the night, and they got pissed off, and they voted hugely for the toll party.
It sounds like the Yellow Vest protests in France, which started because of the rise of petrol tax, and the people who live in the country who drive all the time.
Yeah.
Don't have many economic opportunities, and they need their cars to work and do what they need to do. And it's just a failure of understanding the reality of certain working people's lives.
It's the same stuff. It's the same thing. And that's why you asked about the most important issues. And I mean, there's many answers to that. But we have this thing that we've been talking about a lot the last couple of years, and that's just transition. That's like the term we use. And it's also a term being used by the International Labour Organization, ILO. They also have like this just transition as a policy, like a headline for their policy. Because as they say, there's no jobs on a dead planet. Mm-hmm. So we need to get through this green transition. We need to make society sustainable. We need to fight climate change. But it's totally impossible to do that if you don't challenge the rising inequality.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, you have a lot of, at least here, you will have a lot of environmentalists who are also pretty elitist, you know, and they don't understand the challenges of working people or the challenges of people who don't live in the big cities. And then you can go ahead and you can be as sustainable as you like, but people won't buy it and they won't vote for you. So that's the sort of micro example of the toll party, which is also the example of Paris, the Yellow Vests. Mm-hmm. It's what started a revolution in Lebanon also lately. And you have so many examples of this.
I want to touch on the point you made that lots of the environmentalists are elitists, but also lots of the senior politicians or people who want to be senior are more elitist. And one thing we noticed in the US in the last 4 years is that many people are trying to tell the Democratic Party in the U.S., you know, you're becoming a party of the educated, urban, cosmopolitan types, the San Francisco, Chicago, New York, and you're losing the backbone of the party, which was always the working people, and also lots of the factories, for example, in Michigan, are not in Detroit, as many people think. They're spread all around the state of Michigan. But you're losing that type of working person. And I was wondering, as you said, with these environmentalists in Norway, if you're starting to see something like a similar shift where some of the, maybe even your own party, is forgetting its real labor base, let's say. Are you seeing this shift as we've seen in the U.S.? Basically, I'm sorry for this long
question. It's a great question. It's a great
The U.S. is now becoming, they're going to say, the Democratic Party is going to be the party of the cities, and the Republican is the party of the countryside.
Yeah. Which is a terrible development, right? And in Norway, the Labor Party had this slogan that been running for 70 years. It's called, in Norwegian, by og land, hand i hand, which is something like the city and the countryside hand in hand, because it's a party for both. And that's the whole trust issue, right? That you trust each other. And I have to say, on this question about elitism, it sort of gets to me, you know? You went through my bio. I have a PhD. I'm a director of a think tank. I worked in Equinor. I mean, it's pretty easy for somebody to tick me off as an elitist, right?
Oh, it's real easy for me too.
Yeah.
I already did it. I'm just kidding. I am worse. So, I'm even worse.
Yeah.
White privilege in this room.
So, of course, I spent some time thinking about this because I think identity politics is sort of like the death of everything in a way, but also identity is important. So my background, I come from a family of farmers on the countryside. I grew up with a single mom who was a nurse. My grandmother, who died last January, she had 7 years of schooling. Whenever I had a good grade in the school or later in the university, I always called her up to tell her about it. My name, Trygve, I'm named after my granduncle who was running trains between Oslo and Bergen all of his career. His great sorrow was that his father didn't dare to take up a loan so he could take an education. He really wanted to, but they simply couldn't afford it. And he was sad about that. He was proud of his job. He did an important job, but he was sad that he was never able to go to school. So the labor movement made it possible for a guy like me who then is the first guy with a master's degree in the family, the first guy with a PhD. All of these things is because of the labor movement. So I sometimes hear, you know, mumbling like, yeah, everybody's getting so elitist and and you have this PhD and everything. And it really, I feel they piss on the grave of my ancestors, you know, and I feel they piss on the grave of the pioneers of this movement, because the whole point is, and this, it really fires me up, because the whole point of this freedom movement is that people are supposed to be able to fulfill their potential in life, you know? And for me, that has been, I love reading books. I love politics. I love trying to understand stuff. I love to write. So because of the movement to build this country, I've been able to do those things. It's effort, of course, but I would never dream to say that I made myself. I'm a self-made man. I don't believe in self-made man. I believe that society, it makes things possible. And the whole point is that pride has to go both ways, right? So my oldest and best friend, we both grew up in the suburbs, and he came from an even rougher area than me. I I didn't come from a rough area. I came from, you know, typical. Yeah, my mother was a nurse. She made a safe home for me. He came from a bit rougher background, and he didn't even finish high school. So he had like 8 years of education, a lot of back and forth of his life. I'm not gonna deliver everything.
Understood.
But a couple of years ago, he got a job as the in a canteen, you know, like making food for people at the workplace.
Mm-hmm.
And now he runs the canteen, and he has a small daughter, and he's doing really well. And he writes to me all the time, and he says, "I'm proud of you, man." And I'm writing back to him, and I'm saying, "I'm so proud of you as well," you know, because I'm just as proud of him as I am of my PhD and everything. So it's, and that's the whole point of this society and this model, is that we can't get into a dynamics where we're pointing at each other, you know, them, the academics, them, the rural people, them, the working, whatever people, you know. We just have to be equally proud of people who get up in the morning and try to do something. And we need to support them who are not able to do it. I mean, this is such a huge challenge of our times, because we're them. I mean, actually, I read a speech by Bill Clinton once about that. He said something like, the color people, them, mm-hmm. the women, them, the mm-hmm. Hispanics. We're theming ourselves to death, I think he said. And a huge strength of this society is that we haven't been theming ourselves to something. And we need to, that's so important that we need to turn around.
You were talking about the concept of antagonistic politics. Well, certain elements of the American political culture have mastered that in the last couple of years. Yeah. And indeed, it's sad for me going home to see how it seems that anywhere you go, you are immediately categorized as either part of the home team or part of the away team. And, you know, it's really good that, and I hope for the sake of all Norwegians, that you're able to avoid the us or them politics, because that way goes very, very bad outcomes.
You know, Andy, it's a digression, but if you allow me, I did an art project back in 2004 called America versus America. And it was because I was so angry of the invasion of Iraq. I thought it was I still think it's the biggest geopolitical disaster of this century, and we're going to live with it all of this century. And I'm still a bit angry of the people who voted for the Green Party in Florida in 2000. But what we were seeing here then is that a lot of people just thought about the U.S., which I think is in many ways the greatest society in the world, even though you have these issues, this huge, I mean, the American Republic is something I love. The American Empire, I'm a bit more skeptical to, and the American inequality, I think, is terrible. It's a terrible, terrible thing. But anyhow, I love the Republic. I love the ID. I agree with Leonard Cohen. You won't like what comes after America. But we saw that people were just talking about the U.S. in general as something bad, you know? And so we decided we wanted to do an art project to show that, I mean, the biggest resistance against the Bush policy was happening in the U.S.
Yeah, my mother, a librarian, a high school librarian, was at the front lines of the protest every day after school in downtown Chicago, because she said, "I don't want the kids getting beaten by police. I'm a little old librarian. No police is going to beat me up." Yeah. And she was right about that. But yeah.
And this is what I love about the U.S., right? So we came there, I mean, two scruffy students from Norway, and well, I know one Norwegian and one Swedish, and we said, we want to show people in Europe that the U.S. is pretty great as well, and there's a lot of people who don't agree with Bush. And everybody, I mean, they just threw things at us, you know? Mm-hmm. We were able to fill big galleries in, and we had an exhibition of political art post 9/11, in Gothenburg, in Oslo, in Reykjavik, and people would you know, they would find, we didn't even have to finance the stuff, mm-hmm. you know, they were so happy to show their activism and art. It was really amazing. And I've been in love with American politics ever since, basically, because you just, this type of generosity and willingness to do stuff was fantastic. You know, people came to Reykjavik on their own bill to do a performance, to put up art. But I remember I was sitting in Berkeley, of course, of all places, talking to a guy about this project, America versus America. And he just said a bit dryly, well, you know, in a way, it's always been America versus America. That's the history of this country. It's a very violent place, and it's always been a lot of internal opposition.
Mm-hmm. And that's a wonderful way to, I think, cap off this section of the podcast, because we can use this as a nice transition in 1 minute to some of these external issues outside of Norwegian politics. So we're going to just wait on our predictions for the Norwegian elections, but they're coming up on what date? 13th?
13th of September. And it looks like it's going to be a change, and but it's going to be super exciting, of course.
There will be a peaceful transition of power, I presume.
That I can guarantee you. The parliament will not be invaded.
Okay, very good. I do want to move on to two issues now that I think are important from an American perspective. And it does go back to the Iraq War and even before that, which is 9/11 and Norway's involvement in the NATO mission in Afghanistan for nearly 20 years. Mm. Were your troops in Afghanistan until basically last month?
Yeah.
Have you been with the mission for all of the 20 years?
Yeah, it was an Article 5 situation NATO in NATO. So we went in directly. I mean, this is... I haven't worked a lot with defense policies, Annie, so this is sort of my generalistic views. But
what do Norwegians think about the Afghanistan mission and how it's ending?
Oh, yeah. I guess as the nature of the Afghanistan mission, the way people have been thinking about it has changed. Because, I mean, immediately it was an Article 5 situation, right? And slowly it crept until being more of like a nation building situation or nation building policy. And this happened during shifting governments, you know, conservatives, center-right governments, and also center-left governments, and we've been there all the way. And for a while, I think people sort of bought into the idea that we could have a real impact and build a new society, democratic society in Afghanistan, and girls would be able to go to school and so forth. And there was interesting journalism about how the society worked there. And I just read the book of our current chief of staff. You know, he wrote a book about leadership, basically, and it's been a huge bestseller here. And he's a bit different as a chief of staff because he has a long experience as a special operations soldier. He's a real like elite.
He served in Afghanistan.
Yeah, he served many times in Afghanistan, and he. Well, basically what he says is that in the first couple of years, it seemed like the alliance were able to provide some safety for people. And they would rather have that than Taliban in many ways. And then, especially after the invasion of Iraq, a lot of the focus shifted to Iraq, and a lot of the strategic stuff happening was about winning the violence or war making, and less about building society. And at that point, it just started going down. I'm not a huge expert on this.
But no one really in Norway is saying we should continue the mission.
No. It seems like this is where empires go to die in a way, you know, right? Everybody made the same mistake in a way, somehow. Again, I'm going to have some disclaimers because I think it's such a huge, serious issue, and I haven't studied it. But in retrospect, maybe what the appropriate response might have been, this is an act of criminal terrorism, 9/11. We need to go in. We need to find the people who did it. We need to put them to justice. And that's it, you know. But it's a huge discussion. And what happens if you strike an empire in the center of an empire? It's going to be heavy.
For the purposes of our podcast today, it is playing zero part in the Norwegian elections.
Mm. It has nothing to I haven't seen a single I mean, if something geopolitics usually doesn't play a big role.
Okay, interesting.
Which is interesting since we're a small country, very vulnerable. Just look at the map. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a reason we want to have a good relation with the US. Just look at the map, you know? Mm-hmm. And we're not a member of the EU. So geopolitics
is... And you share a border with NATO, with Russia, and have disputes about various North Sea... I'm sorry, Arctic...
some disputes, waters. Some were... this has been sort of like the pride also of Norwegian foreign policies, that you've been able to balance the relationship with the sleeping bear, with the Russia, our huge neighbor, and a lot of cooperation in the north between Norway and Russia, but also very clear on our commitment to NATO and being a part of the Western alliance. Mm-hmm. I think if you want to... the big issue coming up now is China, you know.
We're not going to go there. Instead, what I want to do is draw the last comment you made about Afghanistan policy from the start. I've been paying, obviously, very close attention to this for 15 years. I taught soldiers at various NATO bases around Europe. So my entire career with my university, my first university, was... 15 years with the Iraq war going on, watching the wounded soldiers coming back to Landstuhl Hospital through Ramstein Air Force Base. I saw it every day, well, except when fighting season was concluded every year in the winter. The medevac planes came in every day. What Biden said, which I thought was a compelling argument, is I'm not going to send another generation of Americans to fight this war.
Yeah.
It's 20 years is long enough, and I kind of believe that. But he said something like what you said as well. This isn't a defeat, like the defeat of empires or anything like this. We did what we had to do. We wanted to find bin Laden and make sure that Afghanistan wouldn't be a breeding ground for terrorism. We did that. Should never have been a nation-building exercise.
Mm.
I think factually he's right, but of course history is about shaping narratives.
Yeah.
The culture. He was trying to shape how we remember, how the world remembers the Afghanistan project, and he was trying to say, let's not remember it as some sort of defeat or anything. We accomplished our mission to defeat al-Qaeda there. Okay, fine. Obviously, there's a huge debate in Washington, D.C., and the Republicans are trying to say, oh, this is an American defeatism, you're turning tail and running, and, you know, we'll see. This is all this labor of controlling memories, and I'm going to use this as my very long segue into our last subject for today, which is the sad subject that we're leaving for last.
Mm.
The horrible killings 10 years ago of 77 people, 8 here in Oslo, and another 69, I believe, on the island of Utøya.
Mm.
The man Anders Breivik killed in the worst massacre in Norwegian history, at least in living memory. And, well, I want you to talk a little bit about this and how this memory is being shaped by culture and society here.
Mm.
Who does this belong to? Is it a tragedy for all Norwegians? I've heard some people say this was really a right-wing Norwegian targeting left-wing Norwegians, or a conservative Norwegian targeting liberal Norwegian. There is something like a battle about how we're supposed to remember this tragedy. So why don't you just tell me a little bit about the 10-year anniversary of the Breivik massacres? And I know it's a huge subject, but...
Yeah, it's a huge one.
Talk to me.
Maybe I can get a little personal in the beginning and just give people context. I mean, now we're sitting in our in the offices of Uganda. It's right next to the headquarters of the labor movement and also the prime minister office. So we're basically sitting 400 meters from the place where the bomb blew off. I used to bike across that square at exactly the time when the bomb blew off every day to get to kindergarten. You know, Norwegian dads, we go to pick up the kids in the kindergarten. But it was, I was on paternity leave with my third child, my son, at the time. So I was home, and I remember the windows. I remember I had this strange feeling, and then I went into the room where my son was sleeping, and this is on the other part of town, and the windows had opened. You know, they blew up from the, what you call the pressure, the mm-hmm. wave,
the shock wave.
Shock wave. So I just closed the window, and it. Maybe 10 minutes went by, and then I got a text message from some friends in Bergen. Are you okay? And I was like, what's happening? Mm-hmm. And suddenly we started understanding that a huge bomb blew up in Oslo. And I remember writing on Twitter after a fairly short time that this is our 9/11, but we will handle it better. I wrote, you know.
Well...
It mean we won't go to war to, you know, because I was sure it was Al-Qaeda, you know, at the time.
As revenge for joining the Afghanistan mission.
Yeah. Okay. Or Iraq war, I was thinking about that. Yeah. Or we will handle it differently, I mm-hmm. think maybe would be the word. But anyhow, then some hours went by, and it turned out it wasn't... it wasn't an Al-Qaeda operation. It was a right extremist who did it. And he, after blowing off the bomb, he went to the youth camp of the labor youth. And he started all his terrible killings, as people know. And people know this story. So I went to work on the day after. Stopped my paternity leave. My wife took over, and I started working. And I got in charge of writing the memorials, the eulogies of the kids who had been killed at Utøya. Mm-hmm. So I got to know all of the 69 kids who were killed there, because you needed to have a sort of like organized system about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was pretty fairly early in my career. I was 33 at the time, 32, 33, but I had this training in rhetoric and communication. So
you actually know all of their names and stories.
I know all of their names and stories. And we were a pretty big group in the beginning. I mean, we gathered like 20 people because we made some basic rules like, no one is going to get their psychological health destroyed by this work. Mm-hmm. So take a break. Give mm-hmm. me a word. We'll bring in psychologists and so forth if you need it. And you don't have to do anything. The second rule was we're not going to make any mistakes. Mm-hmm. We're not going to write something in these eulogies that are not factually correct. Mm-hmm. And we got everything correct except one thing. And that was the birthday date of one of the kids, a guy who was supposed to, I think, turn 17, but he was killed just before he was turned 17. So that was that's a sort of like a big black hole inside of me.
Well, inside the country too.
And inside of country. And then now we have this wonderful thing that you have this whole memory literature. We have, I mean, our publishing company has published 3 books about since it's 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And but I don't read it, you know. I don't read the books.
It's too traumatic.
I don't watch the series. I don't watch mm-hmm. the movies because it's just I did that job, and then I did. I went to a psychologist some time after, and I did a lot of heavy crying and stuff. Mm-hmm. And now I focus on the politics of it and the politics of the thing. But it's, and I think people need to, everyone has to find their way of dealing with something like that. But it was an the most, of course, the most extraordinary experience. But it was a really, in one way, everybody came together, right? Mm-hmm. And it was in the party, political party, people were supporting. I mean, I remember coming on the day after this happened. I came to a place where the survivors had met up in one of the labor movement's offices. And they asked me if I wanted waffles, you know. They were sitting in the clothes that they've been given because they had to swim to get off the island. And they're like, "Hi, Trygve, would mm-hmm. you like some waffles?" And you had this enormous mobilization of
love. I didn't realize that, yeah. by the way. That yeah. To escape, they swam.
There's a lot of people swam oh. to escape. Wow. And a lot of people were picked up by volunteers in boats who came on to rescue because people are great. Oh. You know, people come, they put their own lives in danger to save somebody. Everybody did what they could, you mm-hmm. know. And of course, as a society, it was this huge wave of the reaction was like, okay, a couple of days later, it was the biggest it's not a demonstration, but like the biggest turnout of people mm-hmm. in our history mm-hmm. Here in Oslo. I think more than 200,000 people in what we called the Rose Train, which was like the Rose Parade, I guess, you know, where people, they didn't applaud, but they had a rose and they mm-hmm. raised it. And you had the, because the rose was a symbol of the Labour Party. And you would have in front of our main church, you would have the Rose Sea where people would just put down flowers and so forth. So the immediate reaction was, and I guess I could sort of felt that you, when I said we're going to do it differently than 9/11, I could sense something in you. And I just, if you can let me put it in context, yeah. you know, because I remember Bush standing on Ground Zero. And I'm going, we're going to find these guys and it's either you're with us or you're against us and so forth. And if you compare the speech that Jens Stoltenberg gave, you know.
The prime minister at the time.
Prime minister at the time. He was like, we're going to fight this with, we're going to have more openness, more democracy. We're not going to be naive, but we're going to fight this with the best parts of our society. He wasn't going to war, if you see what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the sort of like, that's what I'm talking about when I mean reacting, mm-hmm. responding differently.
Mm-hmm.
But it's two different situations as well.
I actually yeah. draw a connection to them, 9/11 and the Breivik massacre, because the intervening issue was the conflict in Afghanistan and Iraq and the refugee issue from the Middle East and Afghanistan. Norway has taken in plenty of Islamic refugees and immigrants, and Breivik was complaining specifically about the so-called Islamification of Norway. So I do see a through line from the 9/11 attacks. Mm. The NATO and the U.S. response, the subsequent migrant refugee crises, mostly Islamic immigrants, and then Breivik, the Breivik massacre. Am I reading too much into this, or?
I think that's an argument we actually should follow. I'm not sure if we agree, but that's okay. I think the big thing is the Iraq invasion, of course, because that sort of changed the geopolitical face of the Middle East, right? And I just want to repeat, I think
it's I'm with you on that, by the way. My first publication ever was in 2004, a piece against that.
And of course that made, you know, you wouldn't have Syria, you wouldn't have a lot of things if it wasn't for the invasion in Iraq. But Breivik, his line of thinking is this, well, it's this line of thinking that's been gaining ground in Europe for the last 20, 30 years, maybe. It's this Eurabia conspiration, we call it, that there is this elite in Europe who wants to make Europe an Islamic state in somehow. It's a conspiracy nutcase theory, but it's been gaining a lot of traction in some, you know, some in extremist environments, basically.
I'm going to disagree just a little bit here. I'm sure there's a conspiracy theory based to this. Mm. There are lots of people, and it's not a conspiracy theory, to see, oh, I never saw a woman in a headscarf before, but in the last 10 years, now I see one every day. That's not a conspiracy theory. Going back to what you said many minutes ago about understanding what people experience in the countryside or how they're experiencing. They're seeing that.
Yeah.
I mean, immigration is a reality. Yeah, it's not a conspiracy theory.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that's why it's so extremely important to meet these things with politics, right? With solid politics. I'm not an open border social democrat, to put it that way. And I actually, this is something that many people forget in debate here, but the Labour Party was the first party who said we need to put a stop on immigration to Norway, because you had the first wave in the 70s, people coming from Pakistan, because you needed extra labor in some of the factories, and you had around 30,000, not a huge number, you know, but in a small country like this, it makes an impact. You had around 30,000 came, and now it's a fairly big group and part of Norwegian society. And I mean, the deputy leader of the Labor Party has a Pakistani background and so forth. But it was the Labor Party who said, okay, but that's enough. You know, we have to stop. Because if you have a welfare state of this type, with this type of economy, you simply can't have free immigration. That's not possible in a world with the type of poverty we have, with the type of skills you need to be a part of the productive workforce in Norway. You need to have a very regulated immigration politics. Mm-hmm. So this is something I totally agree on, and we've been working a lot with that. So you have to be tough, to put it a bit bluntly, you have to be pretty tough on immigration, but you have to be equally tough when it comes to integration policies. Mm-hmm. That when people are here, when they are accepted as a member of society, we need to do everything to make them a part of that society, you know. So you need schooling, you need education, you need all the stuff that makes them productive members of society. And well, you can compare Norway and Sweden, you know. We had fairly many people think about us as very similar societies, but if you look, for instance, at the refugee crisis we had in 2015 after Assad and his atrocities in Syria, and people were forced to run from Syria. I think, well, your home country at the time, Germany and Sweden, those two countries took half of all the refugees during the refugee crisis. Those two countries alone took
Sweden
more than
and
half.
Germany
Sweden
from
and
Syria.
Germany.
Yeah.
So Germany is, of course, a country with 80 million people. So you have a bit more leverage when it comes to receiving people. Sweden is 8 million, and they took, I think they took well over 100,000 people just during the refugee crisis. And this is pretty important, because if you're a, you know, welfare society, high level of productivity, if people arrive, they need to be able to go to have a school and so forth. I remember reading an interview with a mayor, you know, typical Swedish, solid, social democratic mayor in Södertälje, you know, city outside Stockholm. And he said, you know, every Monday in all of my schools, there's a kid arriving who doesn't speak a single word of Swedish. Many of them can't even read or write. And I have to you know, make that work in schools where people... for a teacher, it's too much for a society of that type to handle in a way. So I strongly believe that you need to have a regulated immigration politics, and I strongly believe that the labor movement has to be in the forefront when it comes to issues like social control, you know,
mm-hmm.
and freedom of speech and women's rights and all of these things. If you want to be here, be a part of Norwegian society, that's the playing rules here. So that's why we need to keep our, I don't know the English word. We just have to try to think clearly in these debates.
Right. And you do such a good job of explaining these points, but you kind of moved away from the point that I was trying to make about Breivik. And yeah. So I read this article about the 10-year anniversary of Breivik by Sindre Bangstad. Are you familiar with
him? Yeah, I know him.
So this was in the Guardian, and he wrote this, and I just want you to respond to this. This was published in The Guardian a week or two ago. Breivik's terrorist attacks posed a profound challenge to the long-standing national sense of Norwegian exceptionalism when it comes to racism. So he was among those who argued at the time for a national reckoning with the far right, racist, and Islamophobic ideology that had motivated Breivik. For I know perfectly well that his ideas about Islam, Muslims, and the left were much more common among Norwegians than many were willing to let on. So, do you think that there is an undertone of racism in Norwegian society that Breivik exposed that you try to ignore? I mean, how are you dealing with the far right in Norway? I just don't know. I read that and I thought it was interesting.
It's a great question. I don't think there's a lot of racism here. I think, you know, the classic sense of racism where you judge people on the basis of the color of their skin, you know, and their cultural background. I do think it's a totally legitimate concern about what immigration will do to a country like Norway. And that's something that all mainstream politicians need to address, you know. And 4 years ago in 2017, immigration was the thing that Norwegian voters were most concerned about.
Mm-hmm.
And that's totally fine, you know. Mm-hmm. I think it's totally fine that people are wondering about hijabs or which I don't mind, but niqabs, I think, is something. It's a concept that I simply don't understand how that has something to do with freedom, you know? And of course people are worried when society are changing in that way. And that needs to be met in my regard with the two things I said, pretty strict immigration politics and strong integration politics.
Mm-hmm.
So that you fight social control, you fight all of these things. And we've been working a lot with that in Agenda. I don't agree with the racist point.
Okay.
That Norwegians, that I mean, there's been so many examples of when you had, of course there's racists here, but when you had racist killings or racist policies, mainstream Norwegians show up in huge numbers to protest it. It's also the 20-year remembrance for a racist killing in Oslo this year, Benjamin Hermansen. And when that happened, he was killed basically because of the color of his skin. And you also had this huge mobilization against racism when that stuff happens. So I don't agree with Sindre Bangstad on all of his points, basically. But I think it just makes it important that mainstream politicians on both sides are able to talk about the challenges of becoming a more multicultural society and the challenges of that we live in an age of migration.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can't ignore that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You have to give people solid political answers to it. And then they'll be, you know, that's not racism to discuss those things.
Yeah. You do it such a wonderful job, clearly explaining your view and the view of the Labour Party. And as you've been talking, in my head I keep going back to this wonderful slogan, city and country hand in hand.
Yeah.
And I just think it's such a nice way, you know, it's just such a simple phrase. And I just think because we have antagonistic politics, so many places in the world, having a slogan like that, just basically trying to say we're doing this together. And your descriptions, your nuanced descriptions of Norwegian society, I think, really helped me understand the general togetherness that one experiences when you come here. This is not an advertisement for Norwegian tourism. But it's really a lovely place to visit. So yeah, there you go. Yeah. That's my endorsement of Norwegian society. And nice. And one thing you do notice here is that people really do have a sense of community and togetherness. And so I'm going to let you have the final word here. And you can talk about Norway, but if you have any advice to Americans about what's happening with division in our country, please. Please.
No, well, if you don't mind, Andy, there's one thing. Since we're talking about the 22nd of July, there's one point I wanted to make, which might also be relevant for the question you asked about division, right? Mm-hmm. Because there's been a lot of discussions after about freedom of speech. Because, of course, this guy, the terrorist, he was radicalized because he spent a lot of time on online forums and debates where people were spreading these, you know, conspiracy theories. And some of them were people who were simply concerned about immigration and how it would change the country, but some of them were just basically crazy nutcase theories about, you know, Eurabia. Mm-hmm. Conspiracies. And some mainstream politicians would do what you guys call whistleblowing, I think that's the word.
Dog whistle,
right? So they would play on that stuff. Mm-hmm. So you say something that sounds, it sounds fairly okay, but you're also sort of like signalizing. And I think that's, I think it's the most ugly discipline in all politics. So freedom of speech is at the center of any good liberal democratic society. It's our greatest inheritance from the Enlightenment, right? And at the same time, you have this insight that I guess the 20th century, a lot of humanistic research in this 20th century showed us that speaking is a form of action. You do speech, actually, like John Searle talked mm-hmm. about, and Habermas mm-hmm. talks about it, and everybody. So I guess one of the interesting things that I hope we can learn young people now is that you have freedom of speech. It's the most wonderful thing. It's the greatest gift. It's what makes society go around. It's the way to solve conflicts in the best possible way. And your words are actions. Mm-hmm. Your words change stuff in the world. So you have a responsibility
right.
for how you use words. And this debate that's been going a bit back and forth the last 10 years, and you will have some people who's, and I've been in a couple of debates about many people I respect, you know, deeply as well. And they say, we have to have a clear division between what you say and what you do. That's the big difference, and that what's make a liberal society possible. Where my position is, freedom of speech is the most important value we have, and when you live in a society with freedom of speech, if you want to be a grown-up person, you must be aware of that your words are actions, that you are free to act with your words. And that means if you say something, if you say something to a person, it potentially has a huge effect on that person. You should be able to, and in the public sphere, like in the public debate, in politics, we should be able to be harsh, clear, have huge arguments, and be aware that that's actions. And I just wrote an op-ed by the leader of the Young Conservatives, actually. Mm-hmm. And he repeated that view, you know, that as a young politician, I'm able to say what I want. I have the judicial freedom, you know, mm-hmm. To say what I want. And I'm responsible for what I'm saying. And it's crazy simple, you know. It's a very simple point, but somehow I think we're slowly getting there. That everybody will have freedom of speech and it's a broad freedom of speech.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, types of hate speech, of course, and threats and so forth are not allowed. But you are able to put on all types of political views, and you're, as a person, you're morally and politically responsible for what you say.
Mm-hmm.
It's simple as that.
I don't understand the impact of this. Right now, are Norwegians not allowed to say certain things besides the obvious, like screaming fire in a crowded theater?
Mm.
Are there?
Oh, they are. They are. Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely.
So who wants to police one's speech in Norway more closely?
I mean, after the 22nd of July, especially actually the young people who were attacked, you know, they said, people need to think about what they say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have a responsibility. If you spread Eurabia conspiracy theories, you have a responsibility
for the
impact that will happen.
Yeah.
You know, because we've been killed because people mm-hmm. believe in this mm-hmm. stuff, and they were attacked pretty heavily mm-hmm. by mainstream political commentators just for making the simple point, because that was some sort of censorship,
right?
You know?
So you don't think that Twitter should have banned Trump from tweeting?
I think
January 6th.
I think it was a good idea that they did that because it was a matter of public safety. You know, it was people were getting killed. I mean, he was, wasn't he then? Sort of like the guy screaming fire in the theater.
That was a bad. I shouldn't have used that example because it gets really complicated. It's a private company; they can do whatever they want.
That's also
so legally, you know, it has nothing to do with the legal,
you know,
illegal thing.
And also, I think for the global mental health, I think it was fantastic.
As I often say,
yeah.
the worst job during the Trump presidency was to be a U.S. foreign diplomat, waking up on the other side of the world every morning, wondering what was tweeted and was it against his country that he or she is serving in, and if his day was going to. His or her day was going to be terrible.
It's crazy.
I never got any info about it. Anyway, right. So, do you think that another Breivik massacre could happen?
This is an open society, you know, and if you lose that, you lose everything in a way. I don't think so. I also think that our police has paid more attention to right-wing extremism. There was an event last year, I think, where a guy inspired by Breivik tried to attack a mosque.
Mm.
But he killed his stepsister, who was adopted, and in her home.
Mm.
And then he went to the mosque to kill people, but he was stopped by two brave guys in their 70s who were able to hold him down. But that was... It was a sort of like the New Zealand attack, you know, same type of. They're often called lone wolves, but it's a wolf pack.
Yeah,
it's a digital wolf pack, and they influence each other because words matter. But this is something we can't be sure about. I think we might also, just for the sake of rationality and our own mental health, remind ourselves that we don't live in dangerous times when it comes to terrorism in Europe. It's not like the level of terrorism it's been higher before. We live in pretty safe times.
Mm-hmm.
Violence is down. This is not a dangerous society. Europe isn't a very dangerous place to be. And there's a lot of great things happening. I think we live in a time where you have some of the most beautiful political changes happening, and at the same time we have some of the most destructive and dangerous, and we live under the Chinese curse, you know. We live in interesting times, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We do live in interesting times, and I guess It depends on how you view them, because every time can either be, as Charles Dickens said, the best of times, the worst of times, the age of wisdom, or the age of foolishness, because someone's already saying one extreme or the other, and I guess politics is navigating that middle position between all extremes. That was such a wonderful discussion, Trygve. Thank you, Dr. Svensson. I know way more about Norwegian politics and society now than I did an hour or so ago, and I'm sure our listeners do as well. So thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Andy. It was a pleasure and an honor.
We can talk for many more hours, but maybe we'll do this via Zoom in the future.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Just so you know, once again, the views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the guests or the host, not the America Centrum, which does not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Thanks again for listening.